Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water to order on this May 10, 2011. Thank you all for being here. Welcome. Those of you listening at home, we welcome you as well. And it's not a huge agenda for us, but let me tell you, it's pretty big considering our last 2 days, which were canceled. So we're pleased to have some work for you, colleagues. And we're going to start with a bill, SB 695A. We're going to have a public hearing today, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 695A. And colleagues, we've got Senator Boquist in the room. Before he comes up, I just want to say, particularly to my co-chair, this is the so-called BPA bill, and he didn't want to have this hearing, but I'm glad he's open to finally putting BPA and all the rest of the hydroelectric folks that into the RPS, and we look forward to the discussion. Am I off track?
I don't even have a response.
Okay. All right. It's a different BPA, and let's bring Senator Boquist up. I'm sorry you had to hear that, Senator.
I brought my paper bag with me.
Thank you, Senator.
Instead of plastic.
Mr. Chair, do you want me just to start off? Do you want to have the committee administrator?
If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't do anything right. Could you just say a few words about this bill before he starts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 695A would prohibit the manufacture, distribution, or sale of a child's beverage container or reusable bottle made or lined with BPA or any BPA substitute that is carcinogenic or a reproductive toxicant. It also imposes notification requirements on manufacturers of child's beverage containers or reusable bottles, recall requirements on those same individuals, and it directs the Oregon Health Authority to approve and obtain for women, infants, and children program only infant formula in containers that do not leach BPA into formula above a certain part per billion limit.
Wow. Thank you for that little introduction. And Senator, we are ready for your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and distinguished members. I'm glad you invited me to come talk about the Bonneville Power Administration. Oh, wrong bill. Sorry about that. Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. Distinguished House members, I'm going to limit my comments to really labeling in the economy because you're going to get to hear plenty of other stuff back there. And I think most of you have seen this report here, and it says, this is from our own state of Oregon, it says, why Oregon trails the nation? Why are our wages lower? Why is our economy not doing as well as the rest of the state? The states, and what's the way ahead? I think most of my Republican colleagues would say we overregulate. That might be one issue. There's all kinds of issues that process out there, but there is kind of a bright spot because commodity prices are up for local producers. And if you're not familiar, in the state of Oregon, the fruit and vegetable canning industry produces $1.6 billion worth of canned products in the state of Oregon per year. And that doesn't include the $300 million in canned fish products that come out of the state of Oregon also. I think, as you all know, I apologize because I have a touch of pneumonia, so if I pass out here, it'll make good 6 o'clock news. As most of you know, consumer spending is about 70% of the local economy. And that's nationwide. That's the average. And we've all been trying to figure out how to create jobs. We've all been trying to figure out how to get consumers to spend to help out the local economy. If I was able to come to you and said we spent $1.6 billion in marketing or putting out these canned products, and I came up with a mechanism that said, well, instead of spending 1.6, we could increase it by $400 million. Thank you. $400 million, just like that. If we could make this can right here, and by doing this can with this little label on it, according to the industry, they get a 25% increase in the value of that can versus this can. Now, both these cans are made in Oregon, but this particular can is a generic can, And this one has a Food Alliance certificate on the side of it. So this can is worth 25% more in the marketplace for Oregon products. It's the same product. Yeah, I know, it's one's corn and one's beans because I couldn't find the right cans because I'm a little sick. But the basic concept is you get a 25% market advantage. Now, it's interesting because if you go to Oregon and you start talking about the same thing, this can is from Oregon, and this can is from Oregon, but it's worth 40% more. See, this one's worth 25% more, but this one's worth 40% more. And if we could increase $306 million that's in canned seafoods by 40%, I think there'd be more jobs down on the coast, Representative Boone. Probably would be, because, by the way, these are from the coast, needless to say.
Can you turn them around?
This one is from Coquille. These are actually from down on Coquille on the coast, so you can see them. Now,
Senator, excuse me. What's the difference? Why is the one worth 40% more than the other?
This is because it's BPA-free.
Uh-huh.
And it has a label that looks like this with a little sticker on it. Now, the problem with this is nobody can tell the difference between Bonneville Power Administration and the other BPA. And the second problem, and I think you've all seen this one before, made in Oregon. When the only certificate comes out, it's made in Oregon. Now, the interesting thing about this one label here, the Food Alliance label, is this is recognized, and it's recognizable because the state of Oregon, you know, and one of the fewer things that the legislature has done is we've gone out for once and we identified Oregon Tilth and other organizations and said, you need to certify, not the government, you need to be able to certify these organic products out there. If you look inside the BPA bill, because there's two pieces, there's protecting local industries that are already there, and there's the labeling piece. So I carried the minority report and killed this bill in the Senate last year, I think most of you know. But if you look at the handout that you have right up there, I passed a handout here, and in the right-hand side of the hand it says, the race is clearly on to identify BPA alternatives in our industries and is in the forefront of that effort. I just pointed out, this is already BPA-free. And the science can tell you, it's not really BPA-free because there's BPA on the computer keys that Representative Cannon's typing on right there. But the interesting thing that's out there is also on the same sheet that we gave you. There's a quote there from Peter Truitt of Truitt Brothers, which is within 2 miles of here. And it's definitely possible to have a perfectly safe food container that does not contain BPA. And what we're really talking about is intentionally added BPA, right? Because, again, BPA is every place that's out there. Now, the labeling piece that's in there, and I just told you economically, if you find a third-party entity, not the state of Oregon, because none of us want more government, none of us want the state of Oregon stuck in the middle of certifying some product, but if you can identify a procedure and a certification procedure and get a third-party entity that is recognized as the marketing side, you get this marketing advantage. I think if you look on the back side of the flyer that came across there, you'll see the list of retailers that are phasing out BPA baby bottles, and I'm sure you'll hear all kinds of testimony about this later on. But if you go down that list, you'll see some names that you recognize, like Kmart that's here locally, and Fred Meyer, and Rite Aid, and Safeway, and Walmart. And if you drop to the bottom of the list, it's interesting to see companies that make BPA-free canned foods. Let me say that again. Companies that make BPA-free canned foods. And some of those you'll recognize as Oregon's Choice Gourmet down on the Oregon coast, Vital Choice, which is just across the river, Trader Joe's, and some of the other companies that are actually out there doing it. So in the marketing side, what we're trying to identify for once, instead of going and hurting business, is going out and providing them an opportunity through the state in the labeling piece to get a third-party certification so that they can put it on there and the consumer can trust that certification, and it increases the market value of Oregon products. Now, I'd like to stand right here or sit right here, because I'm sitting, I guess, and say that this was my idea. No, it wasn't, because having been in the last go-around and we said, okay, yeah, we had a minority report, we killed your bill on the floor, you know, doesn't happen very often in the Senate, you can do that. And we sat down with both sides and said, okay, we'll sit down and talk about this over the next year when we come in here. And so I went out and sat down with industry. I'm not talking about the international companies and the big oil companies and the big canning companies that are in Denmark and they're in China and every place else like that. And I could go into the whole saga of the American Chemistry Council members, but we won't go there. I sat down with Oregon companies, not Washington companies, not California companies, and sat down and said, okay, and I went in because I knew because I'm in the packing business myself, that, you know, this is worth 25% more. And I said, well, what would it be worth if you had a BPA product? I mean, could you get the 25% more in value out of the same product? And they said, no, it's 40%. That's local Oregon company said that. No, it's 40%. Now, the reason we're doing BPA-free cans, and oh, by the way, there is a BPA-free experiment out there right now in the streets in Oregon. It's happening now. Technology is already there. And we're on the cutting edge of it. And so the issue we're trying to do in the labeling piece is provide the opportunity for Oregon businesses to get on the cutting edge, the leading edge, and to help Oregon businesses out. Or we can sit and wait for somebody in Washington, D.C. to do it, and then, of course, everybody else will have the same advantage. And generally, was it Oregon's the first in and the last out of all of the recessions? And we're still not—we're still a long ways from getting out of the opposite side. I want to close and talk about, because this came up in the Senate side, and then I'll try and entertain any questions if I can, but I'm not a scientist. What we looked at the far side is how do we come up with a advisory group to put together what it is we want to do to certify a third-party entity. And a lot of things come out and say, well, big government, you know, we're going to get the Department of Ag in, and we're going to get DEQ involved in this, and we're going to get all the rest of these government agencies involved there. And if you look at page 3 of the bill, it has a member of the Oregon food retailers, a member of the food processors, an Oregon member who represents a base certified or a certified organization, one member who represents an Oregon-based commodities organization, one member of a manufacturer of foods, one member who represents a public health organization. You'll see that the list is not stacked in favor of any government entity. What industry asked, local Oregon industry asked, was, hey, we'll sit down around a table, come up with a standard that you put in at the legislature that a third-party entity like Oregon Tilth or Food Alliance or somebody else can utilize, and then we want to be certified by that private entity, that non-governmental organization. We don't want you involved. We just want you to help set the standard. And that's how we came up with the advisory group. The last thing I'd say is people come and say, well, there's got to be a fiscal here. I just want everybody to know I voted against Daniel Sessions. And the entire public decided that, of course, I would say how the majority party wrote the thing, but everybody said we're going to have annual sessions. And a look at the recession we're sitting in right now and the financial disaster that we're in as we're progressing forward, the legislature is going to get involved on a day-to-day basis. And I think every one of us has got a little bit of irritant at some state agency because those bureaucrats don't do what I want them to do. I see a smile on Representative Boone's face. And I know Representative Krieger over there has got a bone to pick with a few of the agencies. If the legislature itself, if our committees, and even in my committee on the Senate side, if we don't get more involved on a day-to-day basis and help pull the state up by its own bootstraps, we cannot rely on all of the good public servants and all the bureaucrats here to do that, which is why we said, okay, I hate task force, I hate advisory groups, I didn't vote for the constitutional amendment, but it's here, and that's the way ahead. And we're going to have to do it ourselves if you want to pull Oregon out of this recession. Be happy to answer any questions as long as they're not science.
Duly noted. Thank you, Senator. Representative Krieger.
Senator, you have the can that doesn't have BPA. You open it up, dump the contents out. What's in there to do the same thing as BPA does as far as flavor and protecting us from the metal and stuff?
I couldn't give the exact science behind it. I would even tell you to ask the opponents that are sitting in the back. There's a pretty good scientist sitting in the back of how it is. The issue comes down, as you know, is preservation. How long can you preserve it? What's the shelf life on it? What's the date time group on it? So on and so forth like that. I did sit down and listen to a presentation at over one of the canneries right over here, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, but the science went, shh, I can't even pronounce BPA, so I apologize. I'd be happy to track it down for you.
Follow-up, Representative.
Do you know if there's been as much research into what the effects of what they're going to use there as there has into BPA?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, I know what they're actually doing is going older. They're going back and digging up things that they've done in the past and what's worked and started refining previous things. I also do know that the FDA has approved the processes. Now, having followed up, I don't trust the FDA either, so I just got to be truthful for that, okay?
Are there any other questions for our colleague from the other side? I don't see any. Oh, Representative Boone, answer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Boquist, I want to thank you for bringing this and the cans, because that was my problem with this bill last time. It was, I am all for saving the kids and all that, but what about the rest of us over 3 years old? And I was very happy to hear that it is possible to do it. I knew it was. And other countries do it, and we can do it too. So I think it's like my old grade school principal used to say, what's fair for one is fair for all. What's good for one is good for all.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, what we're talking about here is really the labeling piece, as you know. And as science catches up, what we want to be able to do is have Oregon on the cutting edge. We want to be able to take advantage of it. We already have Oregon Valley companies, and we already have Oregon Coastal companies working in the test marketing and putting products out there right now that the FDA said is okay to put out. And so that's the key thing here. If I were voting, well, do we mandate a total ban today, I'd say no, because we're not completely there. But we can't wait for Washington, D.C. to resolve our economic problems here. If we have the opportunity, if we have Oregon businesses that are putting the money in to make this work, and most of them, some of them, I would say almost all of you have people in your districts doing this right now, because the list is broad and wide, we need to give them at least the labeling piece that allows them to get a market advantage. I'm perfectly happy taking all the money we can from New York environmentalists and people who want to eat natural food and all the ones from L.A. and bring it all the way back here to Oregon. And that's what I'd like to do.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
That brings me to my second comment, and thank you for bumping that up. You're absolutely right, and that's I was a big proponent of Brand Oregon when it was out and thought that could be our saving grace in a lot of sense. You've got that, yeah. And they had a big promotion for seafood on that promoted certain ones, and marine sustainability stamps on our seafood, which just basically target Oregon as, you know, something, a choice to be made. So I totally agree. But I still think, I'm glad it's BPA free too inside.
Seeing no other questions, we thank you again. Take care of yourself, will you please?
Well, I hope the next person doesn't catch my germs.
Okay, fine. We'll have an appropriate pause. Thank you, Senator. We're going to continue with testimony, and I'd like to call Wayne Brady, Penelope Jones-Vaughn, and Louis Pitt to please come forward. And Wayne, if you'll start by identifying yourself, welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon and the rest of the committee. My name is Wayne Brady. I'm here on behalf of the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. I don't think that from what I've read, that the science supports a ban, and the substitute is inevitably going to be more expensive. Otherwise, they'd already be using it. If we require these BPA packaging in Oregon, that means there's a logistics problem for companies outside of Oregon bringing in products that have an Oregon-only product. And that's going to drive up costs. And we don't know, the substitute won't be worse. We've had that happen numerous times. We ban something and we come up with a substitute, and the substitute turns out to be worse. There's a 50-year history with BPA. I don't know what the substitute might come up with. The bottom line is the consumer will pay more, and so we're urging a no vote on SB 695. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. Louis.
Same one here. I'm Louis Pitt, Jr. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. We depend on our neighbors to, I think, help us protect our ways of life that we have on reservation. We have these off-reservation rights, too, that we use to try to encourage our neighbors, the counties, the cities, the towns, the state in this case, to do things that are actions and that are healthy for our area, our, I think, best commonly known as the state of Oregon. When it comes to, I think, protecting kids, is as you know, Representative Boone was saying, is that, yes, I think that's something we love our kids, too, and doing our darndest to make sure that they have a fair shot at living a healthy and bountiful life on and off reservation. One of our traditions is dealing with water. We start all of our ceremonies with starting with water. It's chush, and then go to nusuch, which is salmon, and deer, our roots and berries, and we finish with clean water again. And so this has been going on for thousands of years. One of the things that I think when one moves through life in anywhere is just how much is there out there in this soup of contamination of chemicals and radiation and things like that. And any time a neighbor can get a handle on that, we sure appreciate that, and this is a step towards that. BPA, bisphenol A, is, I don't know if, you know, if just I'm no longer a parent of young kids, is that they're all grown up and grandkids. I got one, had two, got one now because of drugs, and probably will have more. So there are certain times when government can play a role, and I think this is one of those times where we can help make it a better place to live and raise our children and grandkids is through this approach to BPA. On reservation, we have diabetes as an epidemic, and a lot of that depends on, I mean, it's connected to the kind of the life ways of our folks, and some of it, like BPA with the kids, should be controlled, can be controlled by limiting the amount of BPA that comes in the sippy cups and baby bottles. And on reservation, is certainly the state doesn't have any authority there, but we definitely would take command of that and make sure that our local stores take care of it. We're talking about most of our shopping off reservation. We go to a place called Madras, 15 miles away, and do probably 80% of our shopping over there for on payday. With the high unemployment that we have, 60% plus, is that we do depend pretty much on the local community of Madras and on reservation. So, once again, is that encourage our neighbors to do what's best, I think, for our children and do what's best for ourselves. Is this is something that we can, I think, use government and as a way to help young folks, that really raising young kids is a great challenge. I remember the baby bottle at 2 o'clock in the morning rocking in the rocking chair, and back when I was a little younger, and so it really keeps one up at night when you think about what could happen to children, and here's something we can get a handle on them, so let's do that. So thank you, committee, for I think the work on SB 695A, and it's a good bill, and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs supports it.
Thank you, Mr. Pitt, and thank you for taking the time to come over from Warm Springs. Sure. Appreciate it. As usual, colleagues, I'm going to hold questions till the end of each panel. Please go right ahead.
Hi. Co-chairs Cannon, Gilliam, and members of the House Committee on Energy and Environment and Water. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Penelope Jones Vaughn. I've worked with children professionally for over 40 years. First 35 years as a special education teacher, and for the last 5 years as a small business owner providing child care to working families. I also have an adopted son who was adopted from the foster care system with handicapping conditions related to toxic exposure. Having spent so many years working with children, I'm dedicated to supporting regulations that promote healthy outcomes for our babies and children. A number of my families have made arrangements with their employers for me to be here today. So it was important enough for my clients and important enough for my clients' employers for me to come here today and say something about this. As you know, BPA was declared a toxic substance in Canada in 2008 and was later banned in baby bottles and sippy cups. In May of 2010, BPA was banned in France in food and beverage containers for children 0 to 3. Denmark followed suit in July of 2010. I'm here today also as a representative of APSME, Child Care Providers Together, Local 132. Did you know child care providers have a union? Our interest is in supporting working families in their quest to provide the healthiest and best possible futures for our children. They are our future, and they deserve our support. I strongly believe there is sufficient evidence that BPA is a threat to our children and should be banned from all products that come into contact with children's food and beverages, including the lids of baby food jars. I strongly urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 695A. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have questions for this panel? Seeing none, we thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, please come on up, Mae Thompson, Renee Hackenmiller Paradis, and Gail Shibley.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, distinguished members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Renee Hackenmiller Paradis, and for the past 4.5 years, I have been the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you in strong support of SB 695A. So I'm just going to provide a little bit of background on BPA, just so we're kind of all on the same page, and then I want to spend a little bit of time going through the details of the bill, because there's been some confusion about what is actually in the bill. So BPA, bisphenol A, is a high-volume production chemical that forms polycarbonate plastics and epoxy resins. Due to the characteristics of BPA for strength, hardness, transparency, and temperature resistance, BPA is used in a wide variety of products, including food packaging surfaces for cans and metal jar lids, food containers, resins for plastic bottles, including baby bottles, and a variety of products such as coatings for PVC pipes, CDs, and appliances. But BPA does not stay put in the products in which it is used. We know that it leaches from baby bottles, sippy cups, and other products, depending upon the types of things in those products and the temperatures at which they're served at. We know it gets into our bodies, and as an endocrine-disrupting chemical, disrupts the normal balance of our hormones. BPA has been linked to behavioral and neurological problems, early-onset puberty, low sperm counts, diabetes, liver abnormalities, heart disease, miscarriage, breast, and prostate cancer. Studies for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have detected BPA in almost 95% of Americans tested. I believe the exact number is 93%, but studies have found that young children have the highest levels of BPA in their bodies. Young children likely have higher levels because they eat or drink off these plastics more than adults, and they eat and drink more pound for pound compared to adults. Children ingest BPA when it leaches into drinks from the polycarbonate plastics used to make baby bottles, sippy cups, and other products. Some infant formula cans, in particular the metal ones, also can be contaminated with bisphenol A, which leaches from the epoxy linings of these metal food cans. In January 2010, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, stated that they have some concern about the impacts of BPA for the brain, behavior, and prostate glands in fetuses, infants, and young children. And in my written testimony, I provided you a link to the full report issued from the FDA last year. BPA is especially toxic and harmful to children whose growing bodies and kidneys can't dispose of the chemical fast enough to avoid disruption. Hundreds of studies provide evidence that there are health impacts associated with these exposures, My co-panelists, I'm sure, are going to highlight more in depth some of the health impacts of BPA with much more information, and you can also find more in my written testimony, as well as those of some of our other supporters. So this bill's concept has gone through a number of changes in the past few years, so I want to spend my remaining time clarifying what the current version of this bill does, seeks to accomplish, and ensure there's an understanding of the bill components. This bill is narrowly focused on eliminating BPA from a small number of products that children use to eat and drink. So what's contained in SB 695A is first a ban on baby bottles and sippy cups that contain BPA, and this would be effective January 2012. Some people believe that the market has taken care of this segment of products and there's no need for this legislation. I wish that were the case. While a number of retailers, Walmart, Safeway, and other major retailers have shifted away from carrying BPA-containing products, we still know that we can find BPA products in some discount stores and often unlabeled. We believe this provision ensures that all families, regardless of where they live or shop, will not need to worry about BPA-containing baby bottles and sippy cups on the shelves if this is a priority for their families. The second thing this bill does would instate a ban on reusable water bottles effective January 2012. This is one of the ways we can reduce BPA exposure to pregnant women, and this provision would align our bill with Washington's BPA bill that was passed last year. Next is the infant formula provision. SB 695A ensures that all Oregon WIC-approved infant formula will not have detectable levels of BPA as of January 2013. This bill does not impact the retail sale of infant formula, only WIC-approved infant formula through their normal contracting process. WIC is required in this bill to report on the availability of infant formula meeting this standard a year prior to the effective date. Lids in dry powdered formula can have BPA on them, but the BPA does not leach into the formula at detectable levels, according to studies done by both the Health Canada and the FDA. So this would specifically address BPA present in the formula itself, not in the formula can. Oregon WIC primarily distributes dry formula, and we've worked with them during the interim to ensure that this is a standard that they can meet at no additional cost to the program, and I think Gail will share more of that with you. Verification of the levels of BPA in the formula will need to come from the manufacturer. According to Abbott Laboratories, which is one of the three major formula manufacturers in the United States, in a recent press release, they state, in addition to powdered formula, most of our liquid ready-to-feed formula and toddler formulas have repeatedly shown that no BPA is present at detectable levels, making 91% of our infant formula product line BPA-free. Oregon would not be the first state to ask WIC to distribute BPA-free formula. Connecticut will be the first state in the United States to implement their law in October, and Vermont will implement in 2013. We've heard from Connecticut that Nestle has verified that it can meet Connecticut standards starting in October of being BPA-free for formula. And the fourth thing that provision in the bill that Senator Boquist spent a lot of time talking about was a BPA-free label advisory group. This is not a required label on all canned food. This would be a voluntary label that we would set up through an advisory process, as Senator Boquist laid out. As I stated before, this bill is narrowly focused on eliminating BPA from a very small number of products that children use to eat and drink, and also looking forward to create market opportunities that can benefit Oregon companies and provide information for consumers to reduce their exposures to BPA. SB 695 has a long list of supporters, many of whom are here today, and many others that have submitted written testimony. In addition to our organizational supporters, we have heard from a large number of Oregonians from across the state who care about this issue but could not be here today. Thank you for your time and attention to this important matter, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go, go right ahead.
Go ahead.
Now, before you get started, I don't know if you've done this before. Don't be nervous.
Co-Chair Gillum, thank you. Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Environmental Public Health and the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division. You have written testimony before you. Our agency also testified over on the Senate side. We are testifying in favor of this bill as it focuses, as we do in public health, on front-end prevention and population health. Within environmental public health world, we care about two things: toxicity, inherent toxicity, and exposure potential. And there's a rough calculation of toxicity times exposure equals potential health risk. And bisphenol A has both of those latter two, or the former two. In terms of toxicity, as Dr. Hackenmiller-Paradis stated, bisphenol A, according to a wide variety of studies, has shown endocrine disruption, which disrupts your hormonal systems in the body, and they have found behavior, prostate weight, mammary tissue, and timing of puberty onset in the offspring of rodents who have been dosed with bisphenol A during pregnancy. Those are just kind of a quick capture of a very large number and type of laboratory studies. We don't tend to do laboratory studies on humans, certainly not on infants and babies and pregnant women, and so clearly that we have to act, we believe, in the presence of some question of direct human studies. That's why human data are limited, but more recent studies have also implicated in utero exposure can result in epigenetic changes, whereby the outside of the gene remains unchanged, but the expression of that gene is changed. And so you may look for a gene mutation, but you won't find it, but nonetheless you will find health impacts. In terms of the exposure variable, children under 6 are estimated to get the highest doses of bisphenol A. One of the CDC's, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so-called NHANES study, the National Health and Nutrition Examination
Survey.
Thank you, study. Thank you, doctor. Shows, in fact, a very troubling reality that bisphenol A levels in children are higher than in adults. Given the fact that bisphenol A actually metabolizes fairly quickly, what that points to is very continuous dosing, and that's a particular concern for the environmental health reasons that I've stated. Relatedly, children are not little adults. Pound for pound, they drink more water and more liquids. They eat more food, they are also experiencing key moments of development whereby neural connections are being made and cells are being divided and organs and various structures in the body and systems in the body are getting determined for life. And so disrupting at those key moments of development has an impact that simply we don't experience as adults. In addition, they are susceptible because of their hand-to-mouth behaviors. In addition to kind of biological differences, there are behavioral differences that can result in higher exposures. As a result, the toxicity is there, the exposure is there, therefore the health risk is there. I want to point out that there are some differences in the types of infant formula. I will say that, as one of my toxicologists shared with me in a very unscientific sort of way, that liquid facilitates leaching. And part of the reason why I think you don't see the bisphenol A at detectable levels in the powder itself, is because the liquid helps facilitate that leaching into whatever the substance is. Our Women, Infants, and Children program in a sister office within the Public Health Division provides vouchers for infant formula to mothers who do not breastfeed. As Dr. Hackenmiller-Paradis stated, they work very closely with the Oregon Environmental Council in drafting amendments, and this bill, as it was passed by the Senate, safeguards children without diminishing the program's ability to continue to serve those, and the WIC program does not anticipate any negative fiscal impact. And I would just close by stating that I don't know if this committee in this chamber has received it or not, but the Department of Environmental Quality, an agency that we work very closely with within environmental public health, had also submitted a letter of support for this bill over on the Senate side. So I just wanted to share that with the committee members. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions later.
I've been noticing as I've been following the bouncing ball that my spell checker has failed me, so please forgive all the typos in my testimony. Representatives, Chairs Gilliam and Cannon, distinguished representatives, and I have to acknowledge one of my favorite representatives, Mr. Bailey, represents me and the district.
He's one of our favorites.
Yeah. For the record, I am Dr. Mae Thompson. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm a public health nurse by vocation, and today I represent almost 2,000 Oregon health professionals who care about the gravest threats to human health. I'm going to leap over the parts of my written testimony that have already been covered.
And just push that mic a little back.
Thank you. I tend to speak.
Oh, they're very sensitive.
That's good. I would like to note that children indeed are not small adults, and that we find this chemical in newborn children, which means it's crossing the placenta. All of us are exposed to bisphenol A when we eat and drink. We absorb it through our skin, and to a smaller extent, we inhale it in house dust and soil particles. And it is found in the breast milk. It is not persistent or bioaccumulative. It is metabolized by the kidneys, and it takes about, if you stop ingesting it, it takes about 4 days to wash completely out of your system. So this is something you can at least theoretically get around. You'll hear later, no doubt, that the health effects that we talk about have been mostly studied in rodents, mice, rats, and bunnies, and that is correct for the reasons that Ms. Shibley suggests. We don't do experiments on humans, but the EPA has indicated that when you have these effects going across species, we actually find them in mollusks and fish and wildlife and primates and rodents, that you start to suspect that something truly is up. I'm skipping down now to the bottom. With your permission, I'd like to talk about a little bit about what an endocrine disruptor like bisphenol A does, how it works. The endocrine system produces proteins called hormones, and they're characterized by being produced in one place and acting in another place. The endocrine system might be compared to the driver of a car. The driver can choose, for instance, to turn on the windshield wiper if she wants to clean the glass with the little thing that squirts the liquid out, or if it's raining. And in other words, when it's needed. Endocrine disruptors can alter, block, or mimic the synthesis, that's production, transport, binding, or metabolism of these hormones. So it's like when a stranger gets in your car, or you've probably had this experience too, getting into a rental car, and you're sitting there in the garage of the airport, and you're trying to remember where the lights and the windshield wipers and all this stuff are, and you think, okay, I'm good to go, and then you get out on the road, and the first time you need one of those buttons, you fumble for it. And you end up, you know, turning on the radio when you meant to turn on the high beams or something equally preposterous. Because the endocrine system requires a deft and delicate touch, just like that car does to a certain extent, when you push the wrong buttons, things go cuckoo. And so when you study the chemicals, you may not show an effect if the exposure that's being studied is too high or if it's not applied at a crucial time of development, as Ms. Shibley noted. Hormones tend to have the most effect within a very small small dose at a very small range of effective doses. Likewise, bisphenol A and other endocrine disruptors have been shown to be more active at lower doses than higher doses, which is sort of counter to the usual toxicology, especially at these critical moments of development. And they tend to have different effect on different tissues. Now, we're talking about a chemical that's mostly an estrogen-androgen effect. And so these estrogen receptors are kind of where you'd expect them to be. They're in breast tissue. They're in the ovaries, which actually produce estrogen. They're in the pituitary gland that controls ovulation and getting ready for pregnancy, and they're also in your skin, which makes girl skin all soft and everything compared to boy skin. But now, in the past 20 years or so, we know that estrogen receptors are in the brain, where they can affect behavior. They're in the pancreas, where they can affect insulin-producing cells. They're in the thyroid, where they can affect metabolism and neurodevelopment. Normal thyroid function is very important for fetal neural development. And they're even in our blood vessels, where they can affect blood pressure. Ms. Shibley cited the two recent Anhane studies that showed that people with the highest levels, these are adults with the highest levels of bisphenol A in their system, are more than 40% more likely to have diabetes, liver abnormalities, and coronary artery disease than people with the lowest levels of BPA in their blood. Skipping down, I'd like to say that as a public health nurse, and it is National Nursing Week, preventing exposure is our best option by banning BPA in key products. You've heard about Canada and the manufacturers, and I'd like to bring your attention to the 2009 Endocrine Society monograph on endocrine-disrupting chemicals. They cited the example of DES, diethylstilbestrol, and its sad history of plotting regulation and profound harm to multiple generations of men and women through those epigenetic effects that Ms. Shibley mentioned, to urge regulatory agencies to use the information we have now from animal studies to guide policy about human exposures. And this is the first time in the 100-year history of the Endocrine Society that they've taken this kind of a position on any environmental exposure issues. You have the opportunity and responsibility to ensure our children develop in an environment where they can reach their full potential. And we have enough information to exercise precaution and eliminate a large swath of items that expose our most precious legacy, our children, to chemicals to which they just don't need to be exposed. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Vice Chair Krieger.
For one of you, at what level is BPA detectable in parts per billion?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, and Representative Krieger, we have, I can give you the papers that we have that show that BPA is actually detectable in urine, water, blood, and other media at levels of 0.1 parts per trillion. Now, the variation is going to, the levels of detection are going to depend upon what the substance is you're testing, how much of it you have, but we have published studies showing that it's detectable at 0.1 parts per trillion.
Please forward.
I was looking on the bill on line 9, liquids or beverages that are not intentionally made. That's like not knowingly. How would you in a court of law prove that they intentionally?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, and Representative Krieger, as I understand that provision you're referring to, it's intentionally BPA would not be intentionally added to the liquid, the beverage, or the product. And so it wasn't, the bisphenol A is not intentionally added as part of the packaging. That's to get around the point that Senator Boquist made, that there is BPA everywhere, and you're going to get inadvertent, unintentionally added BPA at detectable levels in some products. Now, we do have studies that show that the environmental contamination of BPA is at much, much lower levels in those parts per trillion levels, but that provision in there is to get around inadvertent contamination by environmental contaminants.
Please.
The independent identify third-party entities that could verify BPA, do we have those available in Oregon?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, I do not know of any at this time, the independent testing facilities, but the requirement for the formula provision would be on national companies, and we know that Health Canada and the FDA have both done testing on formula for BPA at those levels.
Sure, please.
And how often would they check a manufacturer
Chair Gilliam.
For compliance.
Yeah, Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger. I would think those details would have to be worked out as part of the contracting process that WIC would enter into. That's what I would assume, that in those contracts, purchasing agreements, that those details would be written into a contract just like any other contract specifications are. But I do not know, and maybe that's a question for Representative.
Just one other one.
Right.
Was when you're testing to that degree, so minute, it's more complex. I would expect the costs of doing it are going to be more than, you know, with other type of things, or much larger amounts. Do you have any idea what the cost of each of these tests is?
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, I do not know what the cost associated with that is. But I am happy to find out.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Please, Representative Thompson.
This bill zeroes in on children's drink containers. I understand that part. But my daughter-in-law is a dentist, and she tells me BPA is used in dental fillings and dental sealants, and I'm wondering if maybe this isn't a much more widespread chemical than just this bill would address, and how that overall usage of BPA might reflect, you know, a part of the exposure that we're talking about or measurement. It seems like dental sealants would be pretty good quantity if you were going that route.
I can address dental sealants. It's not only the sealants that are painted onto the surface of teeth, but also the composite that's used when you are having a filling that's not a mercury filling, and we certainly encourage avoiding mercury as well. The amount of bisphenol A, it's not just liquid that causes bisphenol A to leach out of cans. It's heat, which is the canning process, fat, and a highly acidic or a highly basic environment. And in foods, you're mostly talking about issues of acids. So kind of the standard beast of bisphenol A, in my mind, is sort of canned chili, because it's very high fat, very high tomato food. In the use of dental sealants, when I'm talking as a nurse to people, I encourage people to think about their use of dental sealants. For instance, my daughter at age 3 had some cavities in her teeth that were caused by some just natural deep folds in her molars. And rather than have her whole teeth painted, her whole dental set painted with the bisphenol A, we just painted those creases. So I think there's places where these can be used. With composite right now, we don't have a better, I mean, it's better than the amalgam for our health, and that's good. I think we have to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good in this bill. It's not going to take all the bisphenol A out of all of the children and all of the adults and the whole population. It's not going to take it out of our waterways, but this is a great first step to correct the exposure of those who are most vulnerable.
Other questions?
I wanted to ask, and I will show my scientific ignorance, but you're talking about parts per billion or trillion, I think we talked about, and the fact that it is, this substance is in a lot of places. I just don't know how scientists analyze something this small. I mean, perhaps I'm missing the point. The mere presence, I don't think, causes us alarm. It may cause us some interest or caution, but I don't know how you analyze something that teeny tiny.
I just saw a very interesting short film at a presentation that I was actually speaking after the film the other day. And in this presentation, we were reminded that the standard dose of Cialis ends up in your blood at about 30 parts per billion. The standard antidepressant Paxil, fluoxetine, ends up in your blood at about 20 parts per million. Per billion. LSD is measured in micrograms. That's at parts per trillion. So that we're actually talking about relatively pharmacological doses here. Birth control pills are also measured in micrograms, which goes to parts per billion in your bloodstream. So while this sounds extreme and while it is a very small amount, these are pharmacologically active levels.
All right, thank you. We've got to keep moving because we do have a number of folks we're going to hear from, but I would ask you one other question, which is this. Do you have a perspective on why we've all been briefed on all sides of this thing, why there are so many studies that don't agree? I have not felt that there's conclusive evidence to pass this bill. But there are so many studies.
Gail Shibley again with Environmental Public Health. It's a great question, and I would be misrepresenting my state of the knowledge by saying that we're confident we know exactly why, and I would suggest that it's a pretty elusive definite answer to get to. That said, one of my PhD toxicologists recently came back from the Society of Toxicology conference and relayed to me a very interesting symposium on just that very question. And one of the things he pointed out to me was that the large animal studies, not large animals, the large studies of animals are carried out under what's kind of generically called good laboratory practices. That is, the cages are this material, the bedding is this material, the drink is given in this container, it's this type of food that's given, et cetera, et cetera. And surprise, surprise, the cages are lined with resin polymers that contain bisphenol A. The bedding has bisphenol A in it. The water bottles, if they're not glass, they're plastic and have bisphenol A. A variety of these kinds of very small, as you point out, these are very, numerically very small, although biologically pharmacokinetically very important doses, and these kinds of practices may in fact lead to predisposing them to miss those very subtle changes and blur or obscure what findings they may arrive at.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This builds on the co-chair's question, and it has to do with who we actually listen to and follow. I understood from conversations regarding this bill earlier today that the federal government, the FDA, is going to engage in a very expensive study. Let's assume that it concludes that this isn't a problem. What do we do if we had passed this bill? Do we reverse field, or do we say, well, that's almighty fine, but you're just the FDA? I just kind of want to know who it is we look to for direction and guidance in situations like this, and is there anybody that ever has the final word?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Bentz, Gail Shibley again. I appreciate that, and certainly as a state agency representative, we work with our federal partners very, very closely. That said, almost every part of federal law that we and our partners in DEQ and other state agencies deal with work with state agency federal standards as a minimum, as a floor, above which states are allowed, encouraged, sometimes funded to research even more innovative or health protective standards per them. I would suggest to you that even if after X number of more years, the FDA came out and somehow found a negative, definitively saying this is absolutely safe. In fact, it builds strong bones 12 ways or something. We would be doing no harm in reducing this one or few potential exposure pathways. As I stated before, that the the national studies have found high levels of this in almost every single person studied. And the fact that children have even higher levels than adults leads us to kind of conclude, we think logically, that while an important set of exposure pathways, it's not at all the only ones, and this would be doing no harm at the very least.
Follow up, Representative Mintz.
Chair, I suddenly found myself chewing on my plastic glasses here, and I
did the same thing.
Myself.
I was a little worried about
it. Yeah, sorry. Well, I'm just follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow up.
Yes, please.
I'm concerned because the measure isn't all we look at. It's where we spend our resources, how much the cost of the change is, all of those cost-benefit things that come into play. So it's not as easy as saying, well, we can always do higher standards, and therefore the FDA's opinion is interesting, but not necessarily any more than that. Because then I think our focus should shift to the cost-benefit, and I'm sure we're going to hear about that from other folks. So I appreciate your insight.
Thank you all. We're going to move along, and I'm going to call up three more folks, and I'm going to make a comment while they're coming up. I would like Tim Shestick, Dr. William Hoyle, and John Hewitt to come forward. And colleagues, I wanted to bring your attention to the handout that our good colleague, Representative Boquist, brought. And I would be ill-advised to criticize Senator Boquist at risk of my own personal safety, and I'm glad he's out of the room, but nonetheless, if you look at this quote, I have a great deal of respect and personal interest, relational interest with Peter Truitt. Wonderful person, wonderful place. I'm pleased to get their take on this. But skip down here to the Kroger press release. The Kroger is the, you know, parent company of Fred Meyer. Also good information to have. But my point, just want to bring to your attention, is that I happen to know that they oppose this bill. So they are moving ahead on their own policy. I think that's interesting. That may or may not move you towards this bill. It actually makes me think that private enterprise is moving along in some aspects of this. But I don't want this handout to indicate that Kroger has weighed in on this bill. They have not. Now, with that, please start.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, my name is Tim Shestick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments today. We are in opposition to this bill, and I think when you hear from the proponents and hear a lot of general discussion about bisphenol A and how it's used in these products, I think there's this general assumption that the scientific evidence supports a restriction on its use. I would like, if I may, to bear with me and hear a little bit, not from what the American Chemistry Council says about the safety of bisphenol A and how it's used in these products, and frankly not from what the proponents have said about the safety of BPA and how it's used, but what some of the international and domestic regulatory bodies have said after they have looked at all of the scientific evidence and all of the studies. Just last year we heard a little bit of talk about FDA. When asked if BPA was unsafe, FDA responded, and I quote, "If we thought it was unsafe, we would be taking strong regulatory action." And to Representative Benz's comment earlier, FDA is currently in the process of conducting nearly $25 million in ongoing research. Just last November, the World Health Organization, a panel of experts, concluded, and I quote, "Initiation of public health measures would be premature." The panel concluded that BPA does not accumulate in the body, is rapidly eliminated in urine, and it's very difficult to interpret the relevance of studies claiming adverse health effects associated from BPA. We heard earlier about Health Canada and taking some regulatory action in Canada. In 2009 and 2010, Health Canada concluded, and I quote, "The current dietary exposure to BPA through food packaging is not expected to pose a health risk to the general population, including infants and children." Just last month, the German Society of Toxicology reviewed hundreds of studies on BPA and concluded, and I quote, "BPA exposure represents no noteworthy risk to the health of human population, including newborns and babies." The FDA equivalent in Australia recently said just a few months ago, and I quote, "evaluated the safety of BPA in food, including that consumed by infants and children, and concluded that levels of intake of BPA are very low and do not pose a significant human health risk to any age group." There was a question earlier about the endocrine disruption, and in the testimony that I did provide to the committee, there is response by Food Standards Australia and New Zealand to that very question. I would point out that they said similar consequences in consumers at these low-level concentrations are considered unlikely because BPA is rapidly inactivated and then excreted in urine in humans. I just would ask that the committee, as you evaluate all of this, all the commentary from both the proponents and the opponents, frankly, that you kind of ask yourself, how can all of these regulatory bodies who have studied this issue, have weighed the scientific evidence, pro and con, have come down to the conclusion that that they have? As FDA stated, if they thought BPA was unsafe at use, as it's being used, they would have taken strong regulatory action. They have not done that. For these scientific reasons, we do not believe that a restriction on BPA-containing products is warranted, and we would encourage the committee to oppose this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is John Hewitt on behalf of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Rather than belabor the points that we laid out in our written comment letter, I wanted to just briefly touch on some of the mechanics of SB 695 and some of the outstanding questions that we have as to how that would operate. I would like to, before I get into some of those questions, echo the points made by Mr. Shestick with the American Chemistry Council, and that Grocery Manufacturers believes that that the uses of BPA, as the FDA has acknowledged, are safe as currently used. With respect to Section 2 of the bill, I guess some of the questions that we have really are, you know, what enforcement mechanisms are contemplated or currently in place to ensure that people don't distribute via planes, trains, boats, and through the ports, et cetera, the distribution of these products that SB 695 would look to ban. Skipping ahead to Section 5, in dealing with the Oregon Health Authority, and really maybe a question more appropriate for previous presenter is, we would like to know specifically what peer-reviewed published testing methodology that they would use in making this determination that that products meet the 0.1 parts per billion standard. We understand that from her answer that, you know, or from one of the answers provided, that these would be done during the contract negotiation period. We'd like to know if the manufacturers and other members of the public would have an opportunity to, you know, weigh in on that and ensure that that these are peer-reviewed and scientifically valid testing methodologies that are being used, or if they're being created. To the extent that they're being created, we'd like to know what the cost is for that and who would be funding those. Moving on to Section 6, with respect to the Oregon BPA Free Advisory Group, a couple questions that, you know, we had with that is would this advisory group be subject to Oregon's open meeting laws? What are some of the other provisions that group would be subjected to? I think I understood from Senator Boquist's comments earlier that this would be funded or at least done internally within the committee. And if that's the case, we'd like some additional details about the personnel staff assigned and how many what the cost would be with that. We'd also like to know what the specific costs would be associated with providing this advice, making recommendations, developing program logos, labels, and public education campaign that's also laid out in SB 695. In short, we have a number of questions about the mechanics of it. More importantly, we believe in the science and FDA's position on it, and for that primary reason, we encourage your no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hoyle.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. William Hoyle. I'm here on behalf of the North American Metal Packaging Alliance, which essentially represents the chain of all the way through from the packers all the way through to the people who manufacture the base chemicals. What I'd like to do is, I'll have written testimony. I'll give it to you shortly. I forgot it at the back of the room. But what I'd like to do is briefly, you know, just make a few statements and then go over some of the things that I've heard today and kind of maybe put it into a little bit of perspective. Thing what I would like to talk about is two components of the present bill. One is the 0.1 parts per billion. And by the way, my background as an analytical chemist, I taught at both Miami University and Iowa State before working for the governor of Illinois as hazardous materials coordinator, and then spent 30 years in packaging development, starting out as a bench chemist, going through, ending up as VP for global development for a major packaging company. So I do have a bit of experience with metal and package plastic packaging. So with that, as an analytical chemist, I'm extremely concerned about that 0.1 parts per billion. I don't think people realize how little that is and how difficult it is to actually analyze for it, especially, yes, it's easy in things like serums and what I'll call dilute products, but you start trying to analyze it in a food, to analyze it. And by the way, people talk about the detection limits, and I'll use one of the people talked about, mentioned Abbott Lab as non-detectable, and therefore made the conclusion that it's BPA-free. Those two are worlds apart. It was non-detectable at a limit. That limit in those was probably somewhere around one part per billion, maybe a half, but most likely one part per billion. Canada used the half a part per billion. To do that, it costs about $10,000 to $15,000 per sample. It takes several weeks just to develop a method for that specific food, and then takes multiple analysis in a lab that has to be BPA free in order to get to it. Maybe we'll come back to that. The other part is the alternate technologies. The bill mentions that you cannot use an alternate technology if it is listed in any way, shape, or form in the EPA list of toxicants or carcinogens. Let me use the example. Wouldn't it be great if we just replaced all the cans with glass? Glass is okay. By the way, you couldn't do that under this bill. Why? Silica glass in the airborne route is carcinogenic. Therefore, not a suitable substitute. So you got to understand, you can't just write something and say, this is what we're going to do. And that's why when you look at a lot of these tests, if you don't look at the route at which they're administered, the route at which these tests were taken, they're irrelevant to the conclusions to which many people draw. So you can't use glass as a substitute. I think people would probably disagree with that. You couldn't use stainless steel because nickel's listed on that list. You couldn't use a lot of other things that are on there that are in stainless steel, that are in aluminum, and other products that you use every day today and think are quite safe, including things like PET bottles, such as the bottles behind the polycarbonate one. I mean, and then you go and tell me it has to be approved by FDA. Well, BPA is approved by FDA. Tell me how we're going to prove this material. You can't just write something out and then give us a way to get there. So with that as a start, one of the people then said, you know, so what if we make it tougher than what the FDA is? It'll do no harm. Well, I tend to disagree with that. You heard Senator Boquist say that a lot of the companies are going not forward in their technologies for the coatings that are on there, but going back to what was used 30, 40, 50 years ago. A good one that's on the Internet. You can go on. Everybody uses the Internet. Go look at it. Eden Foods tells everybody that they're BPA-free. But they only tell you it's for a small part of their product line, and what they're using happens to be a bakelite-like compound that, by the way, is very difficult to use through the transportation system. If you dent it, crack it, it splits, and the product now can react with that container and get through there. If you are as old as I am, my kids describe me older than a rock, we talked about things, if you had a dented can, don't use it. Why? You get botulism and things like that. I don't think we want to go back to that. I think that one of the things that ought to be talked about is that you possibly can do harm by going backwards. And according to a report by the Product Safe Product Project, it was an initiative by the Pew Charitable Trust and Georgetown Universities. They looked into foodborne illnesses and what it costs the United States per year. The annual cost in the United States of foodborne illnesses is $152 billion. And that's in health care and other losses that are associated with it. Every year, 76 million people become sick through foodborne contaminations. Hundreds of thousands are hospitalized, and unfortunately to them, those are very real and very tragic results, especially when somewhere around 1,000 to 5,000 die annually. I don't think that's it can do no harm to those people. The other side of it is that epoxy has been around. It's an enabling technology. It's enabled the industry to move forward, to go at higher temperatures, more rapid sterilization, so you get better quality, and you also have a better product. You also have a can that performs from the start to the end. What I mean by that, it works through all of the processes, not starting with the coating, putting a coating on a can, manufacturing that can, filling it, distributing it, and then storing it on the people's shelves. It has to survive that entire process. If at any point along those ways it fails, harm can come to the person that ultimately eats that food. The FDA, their own data, is saying, and I'll quote, is the U.S. FDA records, there has not been an incident in foodborne illnesses resulting in the failure of metal packaging for more than 30 years. The results of that cannot be said the same for fresh, when you hear about spinach and other things like that, or peanuts and peanut butter and frozen foods and all those other highly publicized problems that have occurred. The package, the metal package, enables to kill those organisms that are out there trying to cause you harm. And it prevents that food and that metal from interacting. That ultra-thin, less than a tenth of a thickness of a hair, prevents all that from occurring so that you can stay safe. You can leave those foods in your shelves, and then when you have problems like happened in Japan, what did they ship over there? They shipped canned water and canned food. They didn't ship it in other things. They did that because that was the safest way to get it in, that they could store at shelf-stable temperatures and it would survive in what was going on there. So having said things like that, I could, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things, but I think it's also important to talk about, and I think, you know, it was also mentioned that Europe and others, other agencies, so you don't believe FDA. You want to believe the European Food Safety Authority? They don't work on the risk-based principles that FDA do. They work on a precautionary principle. So if they even think there's a problem, they have to take action. And what did they do? They said, the European Food Safety Authority set a limit for BPA migrating into food at 3 parts per million, per M, not a B, M. And then they set a precautionary divisor of that by a factor of 5 and said, okay, because there are these questions out there in some of these studies that we're not sure of, we'll divide that safety factor, which is already a thousandfold into the way they already set that number, they divide it by another 5. So they set 600 parts per billion. And that is actually the most stringent one that's out there. So having done that, let me go on here. I think maybe I'd like to just let you ask questions. But I think some of the things that you hear about, like I heard it several times mentioned that CDC detected BPA in your blood in 93% of people. Read the CDC report. They don't say that. Matter of fact, they've come out and are strongly opposed to people even using that statement. What they detected was the bisphenol A, well, let me go back. As soon as you ingest any product that has where BPA has migrated, when it gets into your stomach, it's immediately transformed into the bisphenol A diglycoconaride, which, by the way, takes up the two OHs, and therefore it's impossible for it to be estrogenic. Once it hits your stomach acid, it comes out of there as a non-estrogenic product. So having said all that, yes, the CDC found, but that wasn't bisphenol A. It was the bisphenol A diglycoride. And what they reported was as BPA. So people just say, oh, they found BPA. Most of the studies that are out there don't find BPA. They find other things and report them back. So you got to read the science. And that's why you have these expert agencies such as FDA, the European Food Safety Authority, the Germans, the New Zealand, the Japanese, and all these other ones that have looked at it. These people are the experts, and they've all come up and said, it is not a problem. If it was, we would ban it. So, having said all that, and it isn't that they looked at only part of the studies. What they do is they look at all of the studies and then say, we look at the ones at the way they're administered, the route at which they're administered, and the levels at which they're administered, and then they take into the effect. Yes, and so not all, and I heard one person say quite correctly that all studies aren't done the same. But they kind of stopped when they said about the good laboratory practices. The ones that are the key ones actually were done with good laboratory practice. And I think what they were trying to imply was that everyone didn't check out the cages and things like that. That's not quite true. I think if you listen to the testimony that was presented to the California Prop 65 board 2 years ago by the actual scientist who did that, Dr. Shelley Tile from RTP, University of North Carolina. She did those studies, and every one of the bedding, the cages, and all that were all tested and reported in the GLP. That's why it took, to do a two-year study, it took another year and a half to go through all that stuff and get it all verified, get it peer-reviewed. Many, many of these studies are just reported out. They don't even give the total data. They just report the results. So it's very difficult to peer-review that kind of thing. So I think you need to look at all of this and come to the same conclusion at FDA, EFSA, and all these others. And with that, try and answer any
Dr.
questions.
Dr. Hoyle, that's a great place for us to break, and we all have questions. Co-Chair Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for traveling to Oregon today, gentlemen, to be part of this process. I heard a lot in each of your testimony related to metal and food containers. I just want to make sure we're reading the bill the same way. I read the bill to say that the only way that food containers would be impacted is if they are if they contain infant formula that's sold through the WIC program. That's the only food containers that come under the regulation of the bill. There is then a voluntary process whereby we could create a label that could voluntarily be put on products. But a yes or no, I guess if you answer no, I want to hear more, but I'm seeing a nodding head. Are you reading the bill the same way, that we're only talking about infant formula sold through WIC?
That is correct. But the problem is anything that impugns the safety of it in any other way also drags across. So people will now say, if it's not safe there, why is it safe here?
I'm attending, sir, the bill before us is a bill that affects food containers, but only those food containers containing WIC and or containing infant formula sold through WIC. I just want to clarify that. You talked about glass. And I just want to read the provision, because you have a pretty novel interpretation of how the bill would be understood. Because you're suggesting that somehow someone would decide that glass, that I suppose infant formula sold to WIC in a glass container would be determined to be carcinogenic or likely to be carcinogenic to humans, or for which there is suggestive evidence of carcinogenic potential, or a reproductive toxicant that causes birth defects, reproductive harm, or developmental harm. I think that's the only way that glass could somehow be prohibited.
Actually, if you look at the EPA, there are a number of chemicals on there, and silica just happens to be one. Silica happens to be listed in the EPA, the NTP, which is also, and the NIOSH and IAR, all of which are referenced in that EPA document. Therefore, it's included into the EPA document. So if you're using an alternative that's listed there, it says you cannot do it.
Mr. Chair, it just may be a difference of interpretation. I'd be very surprised if it was determined that the U.S. EPA had listed glass as a carcinogenic or likely to be carcinogenic. I understand your point about silica, but I differ with your interpretation.
Just saying, you know, forget silica. How about use something, you know, there's a whole bunch of them that can be used there. You'd probably like nickel, stainless steel. Same thing. It's listed in there. And it doesn't say how it's listed. It just says if you use something that's listed on that list. We went through this in Connecticut and explained it to the people out there, and that's why they struck it. This is just a rehash of the same thing.
Just finally, Mr. Just a final comment, because a lot of discussion in the FDA, and it is true the FDA is completing its multi-year studies related to BPA uncertainties, but is it also not the case that the FDA is officially on record expressing some concern about BPA and its health effects, that they are supportive of efforts to stop the production of BPA-containing baby bottles and infant feeding cups for the U.S. market. They have expressed support for facilitated development of alternative linings for infant formula cans. The FDA is supporting efforts to replace BPA or minimize BPA levels in other food can linings. I mean, I think you're right in the sense that they've got a process that they put a lot of money into that has not yet concluded, but they've had interim assessments that have suggested they have some concern.
Recognizing that as a comment, I'm going to move to Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shostak? Correct pronunciation? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I gathered from your testimony was a suggestion, at least, that we should not be concerned about the bisphenol because the FDA has not regulated it.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, my suggestion to the committee is not to look at essentially only what FDA has stated, but taking the weight of the evidence and looking at what all of these other similar organizations and regulatory bodies have concluded. And please don't take my word for it. I laid out in our testimony that I submitted to the committee the conclusions that those organizations made, and they have all come down on the side that BPA, as it's used, it's safe in these products. Notwithstanding Representative Cannon's comments about FDA's ongoing research, we think the committee ought to be informed by that, not just here in Oregon, but other states. We think that's important research, and we're welcome to what FDA has to say. But to move ahead before FDA completes that assessment, we think would be premature.
Representative, may I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
And I guess I would argue that as a first step, we have testimony here from Dr. Hackenmiller-Parody, who has given us written information that back in the first of the year, quote, the FDA issued a statement expressing concern about the safety of BPA. And frankly, I personally remember the newspaper articles about that because I anticipated this bill coming up in this session. And so as might that be a first step the FDA's taken, issuing a warning as a pretext to possibly regulating BPA somewhere down the line?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, I think Mr. Hoyle has some comments on that. I would just say that FDA, when they did make that statement, did indicate that if they thought there was a concern with the use of BPA, they would be taking strong regulatory action, and they did not, and they have not, either under the Bush administration or under the Obama administration. They also said that they did not believe that families ought to change their feeding habits in terms of infant formula or foods, as the stable source of good nutrition outweighs the potential risk from BPA exposure.
But on January 15th, they did issue a warning to expressing concern about the safety of bisphenol.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt, that statement, I believe, leads to the ongoing $25 million research study that is currently taking place.
Fair enough.
I think calling it a warning is probably a bit strong. I think what they did was they coordinated, since they're all under the same, essentially, cabinet position, what was the statement that was used by NTP. And so they coordinated it and agreed to use that, what NTP was doing. But they specifically said that during that news, the teleconference, on three different occasions, exactly what he said, that don't change. Even for infants, it's perfectly safe. And that changing the food is far more dangerous than changing the container it's in, and that it would be, and to continue what you're doing. They do not think that there is anything unsafe about BPA. They said it at three different occasions during it. And I've heard on both sides, you'll hear, and talk to Senator Boquist. He's really quite up on that particular teleconference, and he'll say both sides use that at both ways to make their points. But read it very carefully. The very last thing that was said by FDA was, don't make any changes because any change to the safety of the product would far outweigh any concerns that they would have with BPA.
Mr. Chairman, I would like for the record to be left open long enough to clarify this specific issue.
Yes.
And if I may proceed.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Mr. Hoyle, you said that BPA is an enabler or enabling agent or something close to
that. Enabling technology.
I'm going to decide a disadvantage without a scientific background here. But I think your suggestion was, at least what I gathered from your testimony, that BPA kills microorganisms once the canning process takes place. I was quite certain that's what I had heard.
No, under no circumstances. If I implied that, I didn't mean to. What it enables is that by the epoxy technologies, when they're used in metal can manufacturing, allow the heat transfer and the use of higher temperatures and shorter sterilization times in the food processing side. The higher temperatures kill more organisms more effectively, and the shorter temperatures maintain the nutritional side of it, so you get better kills of the microbes because of the temperatures, not because of the BPA. It has nothing to do with it. The BPA, once it's in that coating, it's there, it's locked up. Despite what many people will tell you in epoxies are, it's a one-way street. There's not an equilibrium. Once it's there, it's locked up, it's done. It doesn't break down with the high temperatures, at least anything that you would consider it with in sterilization. The highest sterilization temperatures are well under 300 degrees for metal packaging, and epoxies are stable well above that.
Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hold me just for a second. As a courtesy to anybody who may be in the room, because of the time and because we still have some folks that want to testify, I'm going to get right back to you, Representative Witt. I wanted to announce to anyone here for Senate Bill 626 or Senate Bill 518 that with my co-chair's agreement, we will be holding those bills over to our next meeting. So I apologize if anybody's here for those. And lastly, Representative Witt, I want to make sure I understood what you meant by keeping the open record, because I want to make sure I understand what your intention was.
I am asking, Mr. Chairman, if there is enough time before now and a possible work session on this before the record would be closed on this bill, whether there would be an opportunity to submit something into the record about whether or not FDA has issued a warning about the safety of BPA.
And I don't know if that's going to be possible, but to the extent that that kind of information would come forward, I would support that kind of clarification and enter into the record. With your permission.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have another follow-up, Representative?
I do, actually, two more.
All right, and then we'll go to Representative Boone.
Thank you. Mr. Hoyle, you said something about after BPA would be digested in the stomach, that at that point it had non-estrogenic effects. Is it possible that BPA could be absorbed in the body prior to digestion and have estrogenic impacts on the human body?
I'm not the expert there. Dr. Steve Henches is, but my understanding from what I've heard from him saying is that it is so rapidly, and this was also brought out by a number of the toxicologists in their discussion, particularly CDC mentioned it in the article that a lot of people quote about when they found it in the blood, that they find it as the glucuronide. As soon as it hits the acid of the stomach, it is that glucuronide is formed. So there's very, very little time for it to actually get free BPA. And what most people are reporting is not free BPA, but mostly the glucuronide and maybe some other forms that I'm not aware of. But it certainly is not the BPA. And it's, to my understanding, no. And that what is in there is 97% eliminated within 24 hours, and then that goes down over the next very rapidly over the next day or so. I hope I don't know if I've answered your question. That's the best I can do, though.
All right, thank you.
I can get you an answer from Steve if that would help you.
I'm sorry?
I could get an answer from Steve if that would help you. I mean, that's possible.
I would be interested.
Okay.
Thank you. And my the last question for Mr. Hoyle or anyone else from the panel, could anyone explain the exposure pathway of silica from glass containers?
It's not from glass containers. The reason it's listed in the NTP and IARC and the others, and thus by reference the EPA, is because when glass is ground, when it's in powdered form, particularly making, and I think, again, ask Senator Boquist, explosives and other things like that, it in that very, very fine form, it's absorbed and gets into the lungs, and therefore forms nodules, which can become cancer. So it has nothing to do with glass. That's kind of the point I was making. In the glass container, it's irrelevant. And that what I'm trying to say is that the way the bill is listed, it makes it relevant. It doesn't say by route of exposure.
Thank you.
That's fine. We're going to go to Representative Boone, then Thompson, then Bailey.
And thank you, gentlemen, for coming today, too. But I have to say I'm a very strong opponent of using stuff like this. Having been a baby of the 50s, my mother took DES to prevent miscarriage, and I contracted cancer from it. And it was directly related to that. She contracted cancer from it. At the time, it was acceptable. It was said to be safe and all that. All the doctors were using it. She also took thalidomide. I'm lucky I am whole in that sense. And that was considered safe at the same time. All that being said, I look at the things, you know, I hear you over and over again say low dose, this, minimum, parts per million, whatever. I wonder if you worry about your grandchildren, children, you're young enough to have children, and other friends, relatives, et cetera, who, if you look around today as compared with 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, young girls are developing quite rapidly. And it's pretty amazing when 7-year-olds are developing breasts. And when you look at if you take it back, and I know some of the scientists will, and some of the doctors will, and some of the proponents have, you can, all of us had, and my granddaughter included, she's 10, mm-hmm. She had sippy cups, she had those bottles, she had all that stuff, and I have to wonder if that has harmed her. Okay, that's just my preamble. I went to Sweden for this one, and Sweden took me back here to NAMPA, which is, I believe, your advocacy group, North American Metal Packaging Alliance. The race is on to find a BPA alternative in can linings. But a substitute is unlikely to be brought to the market immediately, whatever laws are passed. Go down a little bit further. BPA is used, how it's used. The industry has come to terms with the apparent paradox that while safety bodies, such as the European Food Safety Authority, which I happen to believe is credible, and the World Health Organization, who I also believe to be a very credible organization, do not believe the substance is a threat, consumers were demanding its removal. And therefore, the chairman said in a letter that formed part of the regular NAMPA circular to the industry, you know, that consumers' concerns are real, whether we agree with them or not, and packaging producers were hard at work trying to identify and test new can coatings options that do not contain BPA.
I agree with you 1,000%.
My point is, hold on just a second.
Go ahead.
My point is that, you know, you're in the industry. Your bottom line is all about promoting this product and products like it.
No, actually not.
Let me finish here.
Okay.
And your job is to support your industry in that sense. And I'm glad to see that at least even whether or not your industry believes we're credible or not with our fears and our concerns, that you at least think enough of your bottom line to change your ways because of what the consumers are demanding.
I'm going to have to ask you to keep
answers
as briefly as you can because we want to keep moving. We have several questions, and we still have folks to tell.
There are four pillars, and I won't go through them, but essentially the product has to be safe. The product integrity has to be maintained. And third, it has to go through all of the systems that are out there. But the primary one is safety. But the bottom one that people all forget about is number four, and that's public opinion. Public opinions, that boat left the harbor. I mean, it's out in the middle of the ocean. It's been there for a long time. We've been trying to get out of BPA. If we could get out of BPA yesterday, we'd have been out. That's the problem. We're trying, and we're spending millions and millions of dollars on it. It's not because of what you're doing. There's nothing. Read the Internet. Whether it's true, false, or indifferent, it's irrelevant. What you do is irrelevant. If we can get a material that'll get us out of it, we're out there. And we're trying things. The problem is that most of the products, very quick answer, just in the United States, there are 17,000 specifications for food products and metal packaging in the United States.
All right, Dr. Hurl, we're going to leave that one there.
That's a monumental task.
Dr. Hurl, we're going to leave that one there unless you have a follow-up.
No, I'm good. I know your time is tight.
I'm sorry. It's Representative Thompson's next.
I apologize if this was dealt with when I was in the other committee, but I'm a little perplexed if we're measuring this at levels of 0.1 parts per billion. How can this bill have no fiscal? That's expensive laboratory technique. I mean, I've done some of that, not at that level, but this is not something you do in the trunk of your car.
Is that a comment? It's a good one.
No, it's a question.
Well,
I mean,
do we have
sent bills to Ways and Means for all kinds of reasons. This one's got some really expensive technology tied to it, and we're acting like.
We talked about the cost. Tell us the cost.
I'm an analytical chemist, okay, by trade. I grew up, I taught analytical chemistry at two major universities, and my specialty was trace analysis, okay? Dealing with something as complex as bisphenol A, which is one difficult to measure anyway just because of all the impurities that are around it that mimic it, okay? I hate to use that word. Oh. But in order to do it in a food, you cannot do it with... Most people just use a thing called GC mass spec or LC, liquid chromatographic mass spec. It doesn't work in this case because you end up with false positives and therefore with higher numbers. Thus, you know, read the data that's out there. You got to question some of it and look at that. But I can tell you what we did in the lab that I furnished and ran. The piece of equipment, and there are only four in the United States at the time that I left the company, was a LC mass spec that fed a time-of-flight mass spec. Okay? I mean, that may sound hairy, but what you're looking at is a stream of molecules coming out of there that you've split out of all this stuff that's in there into an unbelievably, you know, minuscule amount, and now you're feeding that into a time of flight and separating it by the weight of the molecules.
Okay, Dr. Hurl, I'm going to have to hold it right there.
That piece of equipment
I think it's a point to your favor.
The point I'm really trying to get to is even broader. I'm a little frustrated this session that we have had a number of bills that have had fiscals that have been very small and referred to Ways and Means where they're trapped. And yet we get a bill like this with obvious costs attached to it, and it suddenly has no fiscal on it. I mean, who's running the fiscal boat?
You don't have a chemist down there.
That piece of equipment costs about $850,000.
Hold on. To Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wanted to follow up on Representative Witt's excellent line of questioning here and return to a statement that I'm curious to dig into a little bit more. He mentioned the warning from the EPA, and I believe part of the rebuttal to that was that the EPA had concluded their statement by saying that they did not urge a change in food consumption patterns based on that statement. And I believe we may have had a little bit of a red herring in that that was somehow to weigh the risks of BPA versus somehow changing food consumption. I'm curious, it does seem like it's possible that perhaps what they were getting at there was they didn't want folks in the public, especially in low-income communities, to misunderstand short-term versus long-term risks and suddenly rush out and cease to purchase canned vegetables or other things that might be their sole source of vitamins or other important nutritional components of their diet for them and their children because of overblown fears about short-term risks because they may not have opportunities to find alternatives. And if that's the case, perhaps this is a rhetorical question, but feel free to respond. Shouldn't we be doing everything that we can to provide consumers and provide families with a choice, with the information that they need, and with safe products that they can know are part of a healthy food choice and providing nutrition for their families?
And I'll allow a 15-second answer to a rhetorical question. Otherwise, we're going to move on.
First of all, it was the FDA, not the EPA.
I meant FDA.
Yeah, I knew what you meant.
Talking about EPA all day.
The answer to that is that how are you going to notify the people that this product out there is different? You're going to tell them it's BPA-free? There's no such thing. Are you going to say it's non-detectable BPA? Are you going to tell them it's non-detectable at a limit? All those things have to be thought through very carefully. And so when you're going to provide them these choices, you have to understand how you're going to get to that information. And from that perspective, so now you've got to have an analytical method. And you can do it the way Japan does. Japan says that we'll define it as free if it's below this number with this methodology.
Let's hold it right there. Period. Unless you have another comment.
I hope that answers your question.
It does not, but we can move
on. We'll have to agree to disagree on that one. And I thank you all for coming, and I'm going to go quickly now. Colleagues, we've got 5 minutes left in our time, and I'm so sorry, but I want to make sure that Stacy Michelson, Holly Fifield, and Andrea Peluso can come forward, and we have two more after that, so if you'll come forward if you're still in the room, and we need your testimony, and I'm going to have to ask you, I'm sorry, to be brief. Okay. And colleagues, I will stick around for the, we have these three and two more, and I would invite you to, but certainly I know you have other schedule issues. I urge you to not read your testimony. I mean, no disrespect. We're interested in your testimony. If you can summarize what you think are the important points that may not have been covered, we're also happy to accept any written testimony. Please start.
Co-Chairs Gilliam and Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson, Policy Associate with Children First for Oregon. Children First's mission is to make Oregon a place where all children are healthy and safe and have the resources they need to thrive. And we believe that all children deserve a healthy start to life, and that's why I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 695A. I won't rehash the debate that's taken place, but I will say that we agree with my colleagues who have spoken to the health risks that are posed by BPA. We recognize that children's bodies as they're growing and developing mean that kids are far more at risk of toxins than the rest of us are. And even in small amounts, we would hate to see any chemicals adversely affect a child's future health prospects or future prospects for success in life due to health factors. And ultimately, children are most vulnerable citizens, and our current laws aren't doing enough to regulate harmful toxins in their beverage containers. We think that this is an important step in keeping our kids healthy, especially when alternatives to BPA are being explored. Some are being discovered, and we think that when there are alternatives out there, making the decision to eliminate harmful chemicals should be a really simple one. We hope to see more government oversight in this area. We believe that 695 closes some of the regulatory loopholes and will ultimately keep our kids safer and healthier. With that, I will say thank you and let my colleagues take over.
Thank you.
Chairs Cannon, Gilliam, my name is Holly Fifield, and members of the committee, my name is Holly Fifield. I am a mother of a five-year-old little girl. I also work for a group called Stand for Children, which is a grassroots child advocacy group here in Oregon. We have about 2,000 members. You've already heard that we feel that BPA is a risk to our children, and it is a problem, especially for children, because it stays in their bodies longer, and they are exposed to more of this BPA, so I won't go back over that. Another issue is the equity piece. We know that at Fred Meyer's and some of the other larger areas or stores, they are moving towards BPA-free products, but places like the Dollar Store and in some of our more rural locations, we don't have access to these kind of products, or consumers won't even know what to look for. So it's not just an issue of, it is an issue of risk, but it's also an issue of equity for our families, and we believe that all children, no matter where they come from, deserve to be chemical free and safe. So we are here in support and want to ensure that equity in limiting BPA exposure moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the executive director of a local nonprofit called Family Forward Oregon and the Mother Pack, and I'm also the mother to two children under six, which is what brings me here today. My children were almost certainly born pre-contaminated with BPA because my pregnant body probably carried it like 93% of other Americans that carry BPA with them all the time. Then they also were probably further contaminated by using baby bottles and sippy cups that were made with BPA. What angers me about that primarily is that that is the food that I fed them, because I didn't know that I needed to worry about this. And when I learned that I did, I became pretty angry about the fact that I felt like my government had really let me down in not protecting me and my children from exposure to this harmful chemical. We spent a lot of time today talking about the market and how the market is responding to this problem, and I just want to tell you from a consumer perspective what that feels like. So I have spent more hours than I care to recount researching every single product that comes into my house because of my concern of my exposure to my children, time that I should have spent working or spending time with them. Instead, I've spent it really researching every product. And to find out what products contain is very challenging. I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not an analytical chemist. That information isn't readily available. To find out what's toxic, what's not toxic, is very challenging for our children. I think it's great that manufacturers are responding and they're creating BPA-free products, but as I learned in listening to the Senate floor debate on this bill, Senator Boquist pointed out, it's great that there are manufacturers voluntarily complying or creating products that are BPA-free, but there is always a manufacturer who will fill a gap. And there will be manufacturers producing cheap goods that still contain this product, and without a ban, there's no sure way to know that children in this state are really protected. I think I'd like to close by saying that one of our members, Susan Beal, who's testified on this bill before, has pointed out that there's really no difference to this debate that we're having today and the debate that was had about having lead added to gas and lead added to paint, not so far in our past. You know, lead was added to paint at that time because it sped drying, increased durability, the same arguments that we're hearing about the reasons we add BPA to canned food and other products today. The reason it's no longer added to paint and no longer added to gas is because of its harmful effect on public health. And the same strength that it took with our government in really regulating lead needs to be taken when we're talking about BPA and our children's exposure to it. So I'd like to close by saying I hope Oregon will join the 9 other states in the country who have already banned BPA and show our leadership with regards to protecting children's health. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much for your patience, and also thank you for your testimony. I'd like to point out, colleagues, that Alex Franco has decided not to testify, but his organization, Mead Johnson Nutrition, has information in your packet. I appreciate that. And I would like to ask Brian Boehringer and Lisa Frack to come forward. While they do, if Holly's still in the room, I wanted her to know where'd she go. There she is. The first time I heard of your organization was in the 07 session, and somebody asked me if I wanted to go out to your rally, and I heard them to say, are you going to the Stanford Children Rally? And I couldn't apply there, let alone get in, and I couldn't imagine why I would go. But anyway, thank you very much for coming. Brian.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I had a 60-minute presentation. I'll round that down to 55 minutes.
We're grateful.
Just kidding.
We'll show you rounding down.
My name is Brian Behringer. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. You have the testimony from our certified SMART expert on this issue, Dr. Catherine Thompson. She unfortunately could not be here. I do want to make her available to the committee if there are questions. She's great on the science background. What I do want to say is that the BPA Friendly Kids Act is a bill that has been reviewed by our community health committee at the Oregon Medical Association. It's been gone over a number of times, a number of years as we've tried to get this passed. It's a big priority for us, and we're part of the coalition, and we support the efforts to pass this bill. Thanks.
Hi, that was good.
Well, the pressure's on to go from 2 minutes now to 30 seconds, so I'll do my very best. My name, Chairs Cannon and Gilliam, and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Lisa Frack, and I represent the Environmental Working Group. We're a research and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C., and I work for them from here in Oregon. Before I say anything, I thought if you find it useful, I have my handy iPad here, and I looked up what the FDA advice was, so if you wanted to hear that, or you all can look it up, too, and maybe I don't need to read it, but it is here, and they do offer guidance and specifically recommend that parents take steps to reduce their exposure. And I think one thing worth noting is what Linda Birnbaum, who is the Linda Birnbaum, PhD, who is the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health, said when they offered this guidance was, there are critical periods of development when exposure to BPA may lead to certain health effects, including behavioral effects, diabetes, reproductive disorders, development of certain kinds of cancers, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and effects can go on from one generation to the next, which is the epigenetic piece. So, and then they issued guidance forthcoming, including what you mentioned, Representative Bailey, about the trade-off with the formula, which makes great sense to me, what you said, which is you can't really recommend that people stop buying formula and make them afraid of it. So I think that was exactly what they were doing. I have basically 4 points. I'm not a scientist. Plenty of people at my organization are. I find the hundreds of studies to be pretty compelling. Myself, low doses matter. That's been proven over the past 10 years. I know it's easy to say they don't. They sound small. I'm not a scientist either, but plenty of studies have shown that they do. I also think one thing worth noting is someone was mentioning earlier, timing. You know, it goes in, it goes out, 4 days. What's that? Well, during pregnancy, it's everything. So when you're 63 and a half days pregnant, it could mean everything. If you're 62, it could mean nothing. We don't necessarily know all that in science yet, but I think exposures during pregnancy, which is the biggest concern here, low doses matter a lot, and the science is showing that more and more. My 4 main points, really, besides that the science is strong and mounting, I think almost every month there's another study suggesting concern, is that number 2 is we can't afford to wait for the federal government. There was a lot of talk about the FDA, and I think industry likes to suggest that we shouldn't do anything because they haven't done anything. I certainly don't fall for that, and I hope this committee doesn't either. The FDA itself has made very clear that acting quickly is not something it can do, whether it wants to or not. They said, this is a quote that they said, if they were to revoke a single use, even just a single use of BPA, and there are hundreds, it would need to undertake what it said could be, quote, a lengthy process of rulemaking to accomplish this goal, which I think if the FDA calls it lengthy, when we can only imagine what that is. And they also operate under 2 different regulatory frameworks for their chemicals, and they have a more modern one, and then they have an older one. And I like the modern one better. BPA was approved 40 years ago under the older one, and they don't like it as much. So what they're suggesting is they think that the newer one is more robust and appropriate for oversight of BPA. So we could look forward to waiting for them to have a newer regulatory framework, too. So I think waiting for them and using them as a crutch to say we shouldn't do anything is really kind of moot. The third reason is I think industry is leading the way, and that's terrific. We applaud that, but government regulation is really the right answer here. It's some notable manufacturers, I think it's naive to think that a public health problem of tens of thousands of under-regulated chemicals, can
or should be entirely or equitably solved by the private sector. It just, I don't think the private sector can solve it entirely for issues of equity and access. Anyway, I think that non-toxic living is a right for all Oregonians. So we need to ensure that Oregon parents of all incomes, all languages, and in all parts of our state, whether they shop at Whole Foods or at the dollar store, can use formula and baby food and sippy cups and whatnot that don't jeopardize the health of their children. Every Oregon child and parent, of course, deserves at least that. Recently, the Breast Cancer Fund did a study. It was a test, I guess. They had five families. They tested their blood for BPA one day, and then they gave them a diet with absolutely none for a week, I believe. And then they tested their blood levels afterwards, and they had reduced by 60% of the BPA. And I think it just is a suggestion that avoiding it is effective, and everyone should have that opportunity. And then I guess in conclusion, I wanted to refer back to the FDA, which is a favorite topic of mine. When the FDA and the National Toxicology Program, the NTP, raised their some concern level, which we talked about a bit in 2010, what they were flagging was concern specifically about those health issues that I listed, developing brain behavior and prostate gland of fetuses and infant children. The phrase some concern for them is the midpoint of their five levels of concern. And interestingly, that is the same level of concern that the NTP determined was appropriate for fetal exposures to amphetamines. So I think what the FDA is saying is meaningful, that some concern is something we should be listening to.
Can I interrupt just for a second? I think Representative Bailey.
Will you go ahead and finish?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's pretty much it. I'm sorry. I skipped a bit all over the place in an effort to be quick. So thank you. That's all.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Berner, I appreciate the testimony and the position of the OMA on this bill. I think that goes a long way on this bill, and I'm thinking back to several weeks ago when you had your white coat invasion of doctors in the buildings here, and I'm recalling a meeting with a group of doctors, including pediatricians, who advocated for passing this bill, and to me that makes it a very clear choice. When we're choosing between a child's pediatrician and industry representatives on this bill, it's a pretty easy choice for me.
Any other comments or questions? In the future, we try to limit compliments to Representative Bailey to one a day for obvious reasons, but I will allow it. Colleagues, thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the Senate Bill 695A. And remind colleagues that we have three bills we didn't get to. I've held over two, which were Senate Bill 626 and Senate Bill 518, and I will be holding over Senate Bill 126 for our next meeting of the committee. And with that, seeing no other comments, I will adjourn the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.